Hello, and welcome to Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. I'm Gina Briner, Editor-in-Chief of Live Science.
And I'm Mindy Weisberger, a senior writer at Live Science. The world can be a pretty mysterious place, and we at Live Science love to ask and answer questions about mysteries big and small, about ancient civilizations, our planet and solar system, the plants and animals that live alongside us, our bodies and how they work, and technologies that we use every day.
In today's episode of Life's Little Mysteries, we'll take a closer look at some explosive mysteries that originate deep inside the Earth. Volcanoes. So what makes volcanoes so mysterious?
Well, first of all, what are volcanoes?
I mean, what we see, you know, volcanoes are so diverse. What we see on land is not actually so much the volcano. Everything that's happening is hidden from us.
Right. It's all about the internal plumbing. So what do you see when you see a volcano? You're seeing, you know, you think of erupting lava and you think of gas plumes and ash and smoke and all that. But what generates that is heat and lava flows that are happening deep underground.
So volcanoes on the surface and beneath the ground come in all shapes and sizes. We have, you know, you have the Hawaii's Mauna Loa, which is a towering mountain. And that's kind of what we think of as a volcano.
Right. But there are also volcanoes that are much closer to the ground that have much gentler slopes. There are volcanoes that are on the bottom of the sea. And basically, volcanoes are just these cracks or fissures or vents in Earth's surface where the hot, molten interior of our planet can, you know, spew out heat and lava.
Right.
And
it sort of gives us this window into the, like, drama that's happening deep beneath the surface of our feet.
Right, right. So it's like this little peek into what's happening in the inside of our planet, something that we normally can't see.
And volcanoes are on all seven continents. They're at the bottom of the deep sea, and they've even found evidence for volcanoes on other planets.
Right, but volcanoes are typically found in certain places. You can usually find them near the edges of tectonic plates, which are the rocky slabs that make up Earth's surface, although some volcanoes lie over magma hotspots, which aren't necessarily on places where the plates join each other.
Right, right.
Just like there's a lot of diversity in the way that volcanoes look, there's also a lot of diversity in the way that volcanoes behave and the kind of eruptions that you get. Some volcanoes, you see these sort of slow, steady, burbling, oozing of lava, and the flows are very slow. And sometimes you get these really super powerful eruptions that seem like they just come out of nowhere.
Right, like Mount St. Helens, which is a type of stratovolcano. It looks like a mountain, but when it erupts, the lava that comes out is really thick and it's really sticky. So it doesn't flow easily, and gases get trapped inside of it. So as it's rising, more and more gases are getting trapped in it. And once it reaches the surface, you have this explosive event. And Mount St. Helens, the big 1980 eruption, is one example of that.
Right. And there's another type of volcano that also gets a lot of attention, and that's a group called the supervolcanoes. And these are really enormous eruptions. So supervolcanoes, they get their name because they've erupted with a magnitude 8 on the Volcano Explosivity Index.
Right, the highest rating.
Right, right. Right. So that means that they send 1,000 cubic kilometers or 240 cubic miles worth of material up into the air when they erupt.
And it's so much material that comes up, basically, that these supervolcanoes are defined on the surface by what's called a caldera. It's called magma when it's under the ground, but all of it comes out to the surface, and then there's nothing left holding the ground up there, and so it sinks into, like, this bowl shape, to this depression. So that's one signal of a supervolcano, is this big crater.
Right, right. And then another type of volcano that is very common is the shield volcano. So this is Mauna Loa and Mauna Kea are examples of shield volcanoes. These are the ones that send out a lot of runny lava.
Right, and they're not explosive like the Mount St. Helens, because the gases can come out of that kind of lava before they get to the surface.
Right. So these are just the streams of lava that just, you know, that just flow outward and can travel really, really significant distances. So there are a lot of different types of volcanoes. And one thing about volcanoes that may seem counterintuitive is it would seem like that is not someplace where you would want to make your home. And yet there are historically, through to the present, there are human communities that have sprung up around volcanoes. And that's, you know, that's been happening for thousands of years. And in some cultures, volcanoes have ritual or mythological importance. But volcanoes can also be an important source of geothermal energy. And the soil around volcanoes is often very, very rich in minerals. So there are a lot of reasons why people would settle around a volcano, where you'd think that, no, that would actually be something you'd want to get really far away from.
And volcanoes do, in fact, really impact life on Earth. And they have throughout history. You know, take Mount Vesuvius in the year 79. It covered all of Pompeii and ash, and it's just like a snapshot in time, and killed all of the people living within its vicinity. But volcanoes also may have played a role in the flourishing of mammals after the infamous asteroid crash 66 million years ago. And we will talk about that later in the episode.
But just one thing that that is true about all volcanoes, they're very complicated, they can be unpredictable, and most of their inner plumbing is hidden from view. And that can make them difficult to study. And so that leads to plenty of unanswered questions, some of which we're going to be looking at today. The first of today's volcanic mysteries is about the unpredictability of volcanic eruptions.
So how do scientists know when a volcano is about to erupt?
Well, Gina, you mentioned the Vesuvius eruption in AD 79, and that's a really good example of an eruption that just took everyone completely by surprise. In minutes, the town was engulfed in ash, and you can see from the preserved remains of people that it's
surreal. Really,
it's just
to see.
Yeah, it's amazing because it was this moment of everyday life in ancient Rome that was just preserved, and these people, you know, maybe just had a few seconds to see this wall of ash coming at them, and then that was it. It was too late.
I know. It seemed, when you look at the images, it really seems like literally they were going about their daily lives, and all of a sudden, it's frozen in time.
Right. I mean, I think there are some remains that were frozen where people were just, you know, either cowering or looking up, and I think there was one of a mother protecting her child. Yeah, so, but today, thankfully, there are networks of researchers and equipment that monitor volcanic activity around the world. And so warning signs can begin weeks or even months.
And so what kinds of signs are volcanologists and scientists looking for while they're monitoring these volcanoes?
So there's a whole array of signs that they're looking for. So one of them is seismographic detection of earthquakes and tremors, because there are almost always earthquakes and tremors before an eruption. And these can be tracked using seismic and GPS networks.
And so that shaking and that activity seems to be from the actual, it's like the volcano is waking up and the magma and things are starting to move around beneath the volcano, or beneath the volcano that we can see on the surface.
So it's like this little like bleh that you get right before the eruption happens. Okay, then another thing that they look for is they look for measurements of ground deformation. So because what's happening under the volcano is so powerful, it actually changes the shape of the ground. And so as the magma rises, scientists can use radar satellites to see these subtle changes that actually happen in the shape of the ground, and that can be an indication that there's a volcanic event that's about to happen.
And so are there any, what about like chemicals or chemical signals from that a volcano, do they give out any chemicals to say I'm about to erupt?
Well, yeah, as volcanoes erupt, they spew out heat and they spew out gas. And actually, before an eruption, there are frequently changes in volcanic gas and heat emissions. And these can be measured by detectors that are on the ground, that are airborne, and also by satellite. And then there are changes in gravity and magnetic fields. There are changes in water temperature and acidity around the volcano. Scientists also look at cracking patterns in the ground, even landslides. If there are locations around a volcano that's known to be an active volcano, and suddenly seismologists and volcanologists are seeing that there are fresh landslides and fallen rocks, that can also be an indication of some shaking that's happened that could mean that there is an eruption that is imminent.
And it's amazing that there are so many pieces of evidence. It's like learning the language of volcanoes, kind of. And scientists have come up with this many clues, basically, to watch volcanoes.
Right. Well, because they have to look at all of these together, because individually, any one of these things, you know, does not necessarily mean that an eruption is about to happen. But if you see all of these things together, then
right,
that's a pretty good sign that you are potentially going to see an eruption. And so especially when they happen at well-monitored volcanoes that scientists know well, where they've observed patterns of eruption before. So this can help them make more accurate predictions.
And so what would, if you were to ask a volcanologist, what is the key? Like, what's the, I don't know if it's the smoking gun to having an accurate forecast about a volcano.
The smoking volcano.
Yeah.
Well, one important key to forecasting accurately is recognizing when the data shows that there are consistent changes from normal background levels of activity, because the Earth is a dynamic planet.
Right.
So there are always things happening, and there's magma activity going on under Earth's crust all the time. And so there's always going to be some,
like creeks and things like that.
A house settling.
Exactly.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. So there's always going to be a little bit of that going on. But if you are, if you are trained to notice what changes in normal background activity look like, then that can help. That can help to predict if there's an eruption that's going to happen soon.
And do volcanoes follow any kind of pattern? Like, can we say, this volcano likes to erupt every 10 years really big?
For volcanoes, yeah, sure. For volcanoes that have a history of being active, there are usually just a set number of, behaviors, for lack of a better word. There are similar clues that experts can see that happen over time, and they can see that there are certain patterns that they can attribute to specific volcanoes, but patterns can change. And so,
of course,
right. So ideally, scientists have a firm grasp of the geologic history of the region and of specific volcanoes. They have real-time monitoring of a volcano, and then they have a deep understanding of that volcano's internal plumbing. So ideally, if scientists have all of these tools within their grasp, they have a better chance of making an accurate prediction. However, even with the very best of monitoring and interpretations, it's still rarely possible to produce reliable forecasts more than just a few days in advance of an eruption.
The dinosaurs probably could have made use of all of that volcanic monitoring, but of course they didn't have it 66 million years ago. And after a huge space rock slammed into Earth, a mega volcano erupted. And this has been a source of debate among scientists, whether the space rock caused the dinosaurs to go extinct or was the volcano played a role. And so there's been lots of research into this and into figuring out what exactly happened so long ago. And here joining us to talk about recent research on the after effect of that meteor or asteroid strike and the eruption is Space.com reporter Chelsea Goad. Space.com is Life Science's sister site. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So how do we know that this space rock slammed into Earth in the first place?
Well, one of the main reasons that we know about it is it left a big crater, left a big scar in the Earth that's actually still, it's under the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. And so by studying that, by studying the impact site itself, and then by kind of pairing that with research about life throughout the years from 66 million years ago till now, that's how researchers kind of pieced that together in the first place.
And this group of researchers that we're talking about today, what question did they set out to answer?
So they came in with kind of two main questions that have been main questions in this field for a long time. The first question is, did the impact itself kill the large dinosaurs, or was it helped by volcanic activity? Was the volcanic activity part of that extinction, or did it just kind of coincidentally happen around the same time? And the second question that they sought to find evidence for was, so after this main extinction, life kind of blossomed again. Life continued on and species proliferated, biodiversity continued to grow. And so they kind of looked to see if that volcanic activity, which happened, they found before the impact, had any effect on that.
And since it happened so long ago, how can scientists find clues to answer these questions, or how did they answer these questions?
Definitely. That's a great question. So there are a lot of ways they could do it. And so they looked at two main parts of the data and research. First, they did simulations. So using the data we have about this time period and what was happening, they simulated not only the volcanic activity and the extinction itself, but what's called outgassing, which is kind of the release of gases like carbon dioxide and sulfur from volcanic events. So they simulated all of those events, but they also paired that with looking at data that is existing on, you know, what do we know about it already, and also what the global temperature was throughout all of that. So it kind of seems like a bunch of random data. it does. But by looking at all of these gases coming out of the volcanic activity, paired with this massive extinction, paired with this asteroid impact, and then paired with global temperature, they can see, well, global temperatures should have been this at this point in time, but what were they actually?
And this is after the asteroid slammed into Earth, they looked at the temperatures.
Actually, throughout. So what they found that was kind of interesting was more than 50% of the gas release from this volcanic activity was well before the impact event, which, while they still don't know precisely if the volcanic activity was directly responsible in some way for the extinction, that did provide a little bit more evidence that the asteroid probably was the main cause, because the asteroid hit, most of the dinosaurs died, but well before it, this volcanic activity started.
So they were already dealing with all these gases before the asteroid struck.
Yes, exactly. And so that's kind of the evidence that they found for the cause of the extinction, where they, again, the scientists will always say, well, we still don't really know,
right.
You know, because it's really tough to know that for a fact. But in terms of life after extinction, by looking at these records mixed with global temperature, they found that while there should have been significant global warming following all of these extreme events, it wasn't that extreme. And they think that this outgassing could have influenced that, and that could have helped life to flourish in that time. They also think that all of the carbon dioxide and sulfur released kind of helped to change the carbon cycle in the oceans surrounding these events, which also could have affected the biodiversity in the area.
So it changed, it might have changed the life in the oceans, and then that would have impacted life on land?
Yes. So kind of in two parts, like, you know, carbon dioxide kind of infiltrated into that ocean environment could have affected biodiversity and life in some way, while at the same time, by all of these volcanic events mitigating global warming, that could have also helped life on land to kind of be supported throughout this post-extinction world.
And it seems so counterintuitive. You would think that you have an asteroid strike, you have a huge volcanic eruption, you know, double whammy, that you would wipe out all life. So it's pretty surprising to me and interesting that they found just the opposite, at least, with this volcanic eruption.
Yeah, and the researchers, with all of this, they did, you know, emphasize to me that the proliferation of life after the extinction could be attributed to a number of different changing elements that were happening in the world, specifically around that event site and impact site. But they did find evidence that it could be attributed to volcanic eruptions, which is wild. You know, all this lava pouring out all over the land and all of these gases, you know, it doesn't make you think of life.
No, it doesn't. It's really interesting conclusion, Chelsea. Thanks so much for joining us. You can check out Chelsea's article, "An Asteroid Wiped Out the Dinosaurs, Then a Volcano Helped Life Flourish," on Live Science. The link is in the show notes. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, guys.
So we have more volcanic mysteries that are ready to erupt. But first, we want to tell you about How It Works, the action-packed magazine bursting with exciting information about science and technology.
In How It Works, fascinating articles cover a wide range of topics with amazing illustrations and photos that bring science and technology to life. You'll learn something new every month, and it's great for all ages and for the whole family.
In the latest issue, How It Works explores animal armor.
Woohoo!
I love animal armor. There's so many different varieties of animal armor. I mean, you know, you've got turtles, you've got pangolins, and there's one animal group that's really well known for its armor, and that's arthropods. So these are animals that have exoskeletons made of chitin, which is this tough material, or in crustaceans, it's calcium carbonate. And the one big disadvantage of this kind of armor, and actually, you know, humans who wear armor have the same problem. It doesn't grow with them. So animals that have these exoskeletons, they have to shed their armor by molting. And then when that happens, they're vulnerable until they grow their new armor.
So they have to crawl out of their home almost, or their protection?
Like, yes, right. So they basically molt their exoskeleton, they shed it, they leave it behind, and then there's a period where they're a little bit soft and squishy until the exoskeleton hardens up again.
And it's not just arthropods. Reptiles such as turtles and tortoises, crocodiles, are all covered in some kind of protective armor.
Right, right. They don't have – those animals don't have exoskeletons. They have a tough, scaly skin that works like armor. And one of my favorite examples is this extinct armored fish called Dunkleosteus. I love that name.
I love it.
Which died out about 375 million years ago. And this fish measured about 30 feet or 9 meters long. It had exterior head armor that was made of bone, and it had bony armored plates that covered its body. It was just this
huge fish.
Big armored fish, yeah.
Nobody messed with this fish 375 million years ago.
Probably not. But there are also mammals. There are some mammals that have armor too. There's the armadillo, of course, which is covered by more than 2,000 scales that form this shell-like shield on their backs. But what's really amazing is that it actually grows in sections. So you may have seen an armadillo roll up to protect itself. So the way that the scales are constructed, so there are these segments that it can actually roll itself up into a ball. So this way its soft underbelly is protected, and all that's available for predators to bite or bat around is this tough shell. And it's not just armadillos. Another mammal that has scales is the pangolin. And like armadillos, these scales are made of keratin, which is the same material that makes up our fingernails and our hair. And fun fact, I actually know that 3D animators who model dragons often look to pangolins as a source of inspiration for the scales.
Oh, how cool.
For their mythical animals.
One of my favorite armored animals is the hedgehog, which is just so darling. They have these, and their armor is made out of keratin as well, but instead of scales, they are covered in keratin spines, which, you know, just like porcupines and echidnas are.
Right. And that's just another form of protecting them against predators that's a little pointier.
Life Science recently covered a very cute, cool-looking armored animal called the scaly foot snail, which is called a sea pangolin for its armor.
But it doesn't look anything like the cute mammal.
No, it looks nothing like that. This thing, it lives in the deep sea. It lives around hydrothermal vents, and it has a pretty unique way of protecting itself in this very harsh environment that's super hot. These hot minerals are coming out of the ground. It creates its own iron armor. So basically, it's wearing, you know, it's wearing an iron throne almost.
So this is really interesting, because this isn't something that – it's something that it generates, but it also is incorporating part of its environment. To create this metal armor.
It's absorbing, or however it's getting this iron from its environment to make its armor.
But unfortunately, even though it's armored, it's still vulnerable.
Right. And so sadly, that armor can protect it against, you know, the harsh environment, but humans.
But it can't protect it from people.
Exactly. And so the scaly foot snail is under threat of extinction because of human mining the seafloor. And this past summer, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature listed the sea pangolin as endangered. And this was the first animal species to be assigned that status due to actual mining.
So it's interesting. So the very same minerals that this sea snail uses to make its armor is what is attracting people to this part of the sea. And so and is thereby threatening its environment and threatening this vulnerable species.
Exactly. And another, just a little like a cute tidbit about this animal that won me over is that these animals have oversized hearts. And basically they have oversized hearts to accommodate onboard symbiotic bacteria, the oxygen needs of the bacteria that live on them. And of course they get nutrients from these bacteria, but they're providing them with oxygen.
Oh, so they have like a tough metal exterior, but they've got a big heart on
big
the inside.
Heart. Find out more about everyday mysteries of science and technology and how it works. Subscribe today to save over 80% and get 3 issues for just $3 or £3. Visit myfavoritemagazines.co.uk/HAL20 and search for How It Works.
Plus, exclusively for listeners of Life's Little Mysteries, you can get 2 free ebooks worth $40 when you subscribe. Get the Book of Dogs and Canines and the book Big Cats and African Wildlife delivered straight to your email, absolutely free. Just visit myfavoritemagazines.co.uk/how20 and search for How It Works.
You can also visit Live Science to read more about the iron-shelled snail that is totally metal. So that iron-shelled rock star can survive the deep sea environment, but could it survive a mega eruption of Yellowstone? Our next mystery, what if the Yellowstone supervolcano erupted?
So there's the supervolcanoes that we talked about before, these mega, massive, enormous volcanoes that are incredibly powerful. There's one in the U.S.
Exactly. And you might not even know you're walking on it. Yellowstone National Park is sitting squarely on top of a supervolcano. And it's the park is made up of these huge, three huge sort of depressions or bowl-shaped craters. And those are from 3 mega eruptions that happened throughout history.
And how old were those? How old were those eruptions?
So the oldest happened 2.1 million years ago, followed by another one about 1 million years after that. And then one, the most recent, was 640,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So we talked a little before about the explosivity index. What does that mean in terms of the scope of the explosion?
So it's all about energy, the explosiveness of a volcano. It means that there's enough energy and enough stuff coming up from beneath the volcano to send up, and they came up with an actual number, 240 cubic miles of tephra, which is all the fragments, all the ash and everything coming up from a volcano. And it has the energy to eject that material 12 miles into the air.
Okay. So what do scientists know what some of these past eruptions of the supervolcano at Yellowstone may have looked like?
Yeah. And so they are looking at these past eruptions to see what might happen today. And they know that the most recent eruption, which was the one 640,000 years ago, so not so recent, it was 2,500 times bigger than the epic 1980 eruption of Mount St. Helens, which we were talking about earlier.
That is a transformative eruption. So that would have some serious – if that were to happen today, that would have some serious repercussions.
Exactly. And one estimate is the ash that came out of the volcanoes, and scientists estimated from all 3 of these big eruptions of Yellowstone, that it would fill up the entire Grand Canyon, which – yeah, massive amount.
So in terms of explosive energy, what does that mean?
So I asked an earth scientist, Stephen Sparks, at the University of Bristol to give me a sense of how such an eruption would compare to, say, the atomic bomb of Hiroshima. And he said, you know, it's a little hard to compare the two, but the amount of explosive or kinetic energy is something like 100,000 times greater for Yellowstone than it would be for the atomic bomb. So it would have to be released over many hours to days. You know, an atomic bomb is released over minutes or seconds. But over those days, it would be 100,000 times greater than an atomic bomb.
Yeah. I mean, so what happens to the landscape when a volcano erupts with that much force?
With this kind of explosivity, you're not so worried about the lava, because that lava would probably come out. It would stay within in the park boundaries. The biggest thing that we worry about with such an explosive eruption is the ash. And apparently this ash forms sort of like an umbrella-shaped cloud. And because of that structure, it can really carry all of that material pretty far across the landscape.
And so once it does that, then what does that mean?
So studies have shown that it can literally impact about an area about 500 miles across. And so that has like ramifications for agriculture. It clogs up rivers.
Well, it blocks the sunlight. So that could affect crops. That can affect other kinds of plants.
And it can even affect the climate. You know, besides the cloud coming up, with that cloud is a lot of there's lots of gases, as we were talking about, for monitoring volcanoes. And these sulfur dioxide compounds, once they get into the air, they become sort of an aerosol. And so they absorb the sunlight and then they reflect that sunlight back out to space. So you get an extreme cooling.
Right. So hundreds of thousands of years ago, when the last big eruption happened, not so many people living in the Yellowstone area as there are today. So what would this mean for people living in that part of the country?
So it would be devastating. You know, scientists assured me that it would not wipe out all life on Earth, despite, you know, the movie scenarios of such an eruption.
That's reassuring.
But Professor Sparks, who I spoke with, said that you'd probably find that the number of people who live within, you know, 100 kilometers or about 60 miles or so of Yellowstone, you would assume that they would not have time to escape. So however many people live within that region. But the devastation would probably continue for years in terms of the climate cooling and, you know, the impact on agriculture and natural life.
And then, of course, the big question is, okay, so then when could this volcano potentially erupt again?
I know, right? I mean, it's been, you know, more than 600,000 years.
Are we due? Are we due for another eruption?
And you see that a lot, that, of course, you know, Yellowstone's due for another eruption. But, you know, the U.S. Geological Survey, the geologists there basically say that you cannot say the volcano is overdue for an eruption because it doesn't follow a schedule.
Right.
So, you know, most scientists think that the magma buildup, you know, so much magma underneath the volcano moving to the surface would be detectable for weeks, maybe years preceding such a mega eruption. And you'd see the things we were talking about when predicting or forecasting volcanoes. You'd have these earthquake swarms, these gas emissions. You'd have the ground deformation.
So there would be signs that you could see that would probably be dramatically different from the normal activity that you have around Yellowstone right now.
Exactly. Because, you know, it seems like there are reports of rumblings all the time around Yellowstone. You have lots of trembles. And that's true because the volcano is active. It breathes. It swells and it sinks as gases and fluids move around beneath the park. And so the day-to-day shaking is not, you know, a sign that doomsday is coming.
So the bottom line is that we shouldn't panic.
Right. We shouldn't panic. We don't know when or if it will happen soon, but we know we'll have adequate warning.
Okay. Well, that's a relief.
It is.
From supervolcanoes to regular volcanoes, over time, the behavior of these potentially explosive structures helps scientists to understand and predict how volcanoes might erupt in the future and how that could affect people who live near active volcanoes. Here to talk to us about that is Dr. Jessica Ball, the Associate Scientist in Charge for Hazard Assessment and Communication at the U.S. Geological Survey's California Volcano Observatory. Dr. Ball, thank you for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
So tell us about what you do at USGS. What does it mean to perform hazard assessment for volcanoes?
So a hazard assessment for a volcano is a summing up of all the hazards that could possibly occur were the volcano to erupt or have unrest, and where they might go. And nowadays, we're actually adding another layer to that to include things like what infrastructure might be affected or what critical resources might be in the way or how many people might be affected by a particular hazard.
And what are some of the tools that scientists use to monitor and track volcanic activity?
So there are three different things that we sort of base the majority of our monitoring on. The first is earthquakes. So we monitor volcanoes seismically. We have seismometers placed in various positions around and near a volcano, sometimes on it. And when magma is moving in the plumbing system of a volcano, it either shakes the rocks around it or it breaks them. And we can see this in the type and number of earthquakes and also where those earthquakes are occurring. The second thing that we monitor pretty closely is the shape of the volcano. So we monitor deformation, and we do this with a combination of satellite radar images and also GPS units on the ground. And then the last thing that we monitor on potentially active volcanoes is gas emissions. So the type and amount of gas can indicate where magma is in a volcano's plumbing system, whether it's ascending or whether it's just sitting there sort of degassing passively. And together, these three things will usually give us a pretty good indication if a volcano is working its way towards an eruption or awakening after a long period of quiet.
What would you say are the factors that influence how frequently a volcano erupts?
One of those factors would be the type of magma that the volcano typically erupts. Volcanoes that have more silica in their magma tend to have stickier magma, and this makes it harder for gases to escape that melt, and those volcanoes tend to erupt explosively. Volcanoes where there is less silica in the magma tend to have magma that forms things like basalt, where the gases can escape more easily, and that kind of magma will flow when it erupts.
So there are some volcanoes that were once active but haven't erupted for thousands or even hundreds of thousands of years. What makes a volcano stop erupting? And could a volcano that's been asleep for centuries or even millennia wake up and erupt again?
Right. So in this case, it's kind of about supply and demand when it comes to the magma. If there's not enough gas in the magma beneath a volcano to force it to erupt, to drive an eruption, then it has no oomph to get to the surface, and it will just sit there underneath the volcano and crystallize. Also, if there isn't enough magma beneath a volcano, you can have a situation where it just sits there without erupting. So magma is supplied from the mantle in some cases. So it's really a deep process that you're thinking about. And we don't know all of the factors that lead to magma supply from depth. So we can make some inferences based on how the volcanoes behaved in the past and if we think it might do the same thing in the future.
Some locations around the world, like Hawaii, Indonesia, Japan, New Zealand, they're known for frequent volcanic eruptions. And then by comparison, there are places that have no eruptions, or at least none in recent history. Why are volcanoes more common in some parts of the world than in others?
In some cases, that has to do with plate tectonics. So a lot of volcanoes occur either in places where active subduction is going on and one plate is diving beneath another plate and producing magma, which in turn feeds those volcanoes, or passing over a hot spot where you have an upwelling of hot material from the mantle supplying the volcanoes with magma. So over time, the position of the plates change and what they're doing changes. And that can have an effect on where and how much activity occurs at volcanoes. And then sometimes what we're seeing when a volcano reawakens after what seems like a long period to us is just a symptom of the volcano operating on geologic time rather than human time scales. So a few thousand years is long enough for humans to forget what happened at a volcano, but it's nothing on a geologic time scale.
Okay, and then I know this is a question that a lot of people are waiting to hear the answer to. How does the research done by you and other scientists translate into strategies for keeping people safe?
So that's a great question. The research that we do is often based around figuring out the eruptive history of the volcano. So how often it's erupted, how big those eruptions were, what happened during the eruptions, what kind of hazards they produced. And we say that the past is the key to the future. So a volcano that's done something in the past could do something in the future. And that's how we plan for future eruptions when we're doing things like hazard assessments and assisting our stakeholders. We say, here's what the volcano has done in the past. Here's what it's capable of. Here's what you might want to plan for in the future. And because we've also done crisis responses at active volcanoes, we can say, here's what this hazard looks like, and here's how you can respond to it.
There was a Twitter hashtag a few years ago that encouraged scientists to share stories about their fieldwork that didn't go quite as planned. It was called Fieldwork Fail, and I believe you tweeted about a volcano-related incident. Would you mind telling our listeners about it?
Absolutely. So this story comes from when I was a baby volcanologist, you could say. I was an undergraduate, and my college ran field trips to different places at the beginning of each summer. And this year we happened to be going to Hawaii. And we met up with a scientist who offered to take us out to the active lava flows at Kilauea volcano. And at the time, Kilauea was erupting in such a way that you could walk up to a lava flow and be reasonably safe as long as you followed some basic precautions. But the part that we had to sort of struggle through on the way there was that the lava flows were not close to any of the trails or roads. So we spent a good part of the morning hiking to these lava flows. And hiking over lava is like hiking over broken glass. It's nasty. It's sharp. It's black. And so when the sun comes out, it gets very hot. And when you're actually standing near molten lava, it's extremely hot. So this was my first sight of molten lava. I was very excited. And I was standing in one place, perhaps for a little too long. And when you do that, even the sturdiest hiking boots will start to melt.
Yikes!
Or the soles will. And so my rubber hiking boot soles got a little goopy.
Oh, no!
And so at the end of that day, we'd all hiked back, and my shoes mostly survived. So that was good. I had them for the rest of the trip. But the next thing that we did was go to a beach where we had to cross a stream. And I unwisely did this in my hiking boots. And being leather, which is actually a good thing on lava, but not in other situations, they got wet and they shrank. So that trip was the end of those hiking boots.
And did that affect your future buying decisions about fieldwork shoes?
Yes, it absolutely did. And now I have a pair of Wildland fire boots, which are actually meant to withstand high temperatures like that.
I have one more question for you. What inspires you the most about your work with volcanoes? What keeps that spark burning?
So I guess it's two things. One thing is that when I visit a volcano, I really experience it sort of as its own creature. A volcano has a personality to me. And when you study it, it's like learning its moods and learning its habits. And you really have a sense of presence sometimes. So that excites me. And it also keeps me cautious, which is a good thing. And the other side of it is that I love science, but I want to make sure that my science is useful for other people, that I'm not just answering a question that I want to answer. I want my work to mean something to anyone who's having to deal with a volcano or an eruption or hazards or, you know, even just figuring out how to live with an active volcano. I want to do something good for people.
I've been talking to volcanologist Dr. Jessica Ball. You can find out more about her work on her blog, Magma Cum Laude, and by following her on Twitter. Links are in the show notes. Dr. Ball, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thanks for the opportunity to chat.
In the time it takes for me to finish this sentence, 20 volcanoes somewhere on the planet just erupted. And there are about 1,500 potentially active volcanoes on land, and it's unknown how many volcanoes there are on the seafloor.
That's a lot of volcanoes.
It is. It is a lot of volcanoes. So, and that brings us to our final mystery, which is, what if every volcano on Earth erupted at the same time?
So what are the chances of this actually happening?
They're so small that it's pretty much impossible. Scientists are pretty clear about that. There is really that you do not need to add this to the list of things that you're worried about. There is really almost no chance that every volcano on Earth is going to somehow erupt at the same time. But
it's an interesting thought experiment.
It's an interesting thing to think about. So worldwide, there are about 1,500 potentially active volcanoes, which means that they've erupted at least once since the beginning of the Holocene period, which is about 11,650 years ago. And of those, about 500 have erupted during recorded human history.
And that doesn't even count the volcanoes on the seafloor that we can't see.
It doesn't. And it's unknown how many of those there might be. Scientists have not yet been able to count all of the volcanoes that exist on the seafloor because not all of the seafloor has been mapped.
So if this did happen, and we're saying it will not, but
right.
if all of these volcanoes on Earth erupted at once, what would happen? Would life as we know it basically be wiped out?
It would be a transformative experience. So the explosions and the lava flows obviously would be deadly to people and living things that are close by the volcanoes. But that would only be a fraction of the casualties that would be caused by what would come next, which is, of course, catastrophic climate change.
Right. And so that would be caused by this thick layer of ash that gets, I mean, all of these volcanoes erupting at once, that's going to be one humongous cloud of ash and dust and gases that are going to blanket Earth.
Right. And when that happens, that blocks out the sunlight, and that clouds like that can linger in the atmosphere for up to 10 years. It can disrupt photosynthesis. It can pretty much end agriculture as we know it.
Right. And life needs sunlight. We needs the sunlight to grow.
Right, right. And actually, we got like a little bit of a glimpse of this from an eruption in 1991. So when Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines erupted, the plume of that volcano injected about 15 million tons of sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere. So, and that's
incredible.
So the stratosphere is about 6 to 30 miles or 10 to 50 kilometers in altitude. And when that happened, then it reacted, this plume reacted with water to form a layer, like a hazy layer of aerosol particles. So mostly sulfuric acid droplets. And then strong stratospheric winds distributed this all around the globe.
And so how much cooling are we talking about?
Well, when that happened, that cooled Earth for the next 2 years. And scientists measured a drop in the average global temperature of about 1 degree Fahrenheit, which is about 0.6 degrees Celsius.
And that's one volcano.
And that was just one volcano. Yeah. So if you can imagine if the 500 volcanoes that have been active throughout human history just all exploded at once, yeah, that would be some pretty significant cooling, probably.
So it's not just the ash and blocking the sunlight that was affected by the Mount Pinatubo eruption. Also, the volcanic gases can create something called acid rain.
Right. And what that can do is that can destroy any crops that aren't already being smothered by ash. It can contaminate freshwater and groundwater and water in the ocean. And then ocean acidification will start killing marine life all the way up the food chain. So starting with the smallest creatures going up to the bigger ones that people eat, and all of the food webs in the ocean will be disrupted. And wide scale, widespread death and destruction everywhere.
We're killing off, marine life, land life, animals,
and then there's,
plants.
Then there's, I almost forgot about the increasing CO2 levels. So then you've also got more CO2 in the atmosphere, and that's going to kill animals on land too. So basically, you've got you're poisoning the oceans, you're poisoning life on land, you're cooling the planet. So
it's like a perfect storm, basically, for killing life.
For eradicating life as we know it.
There must be some niche or some animal or plant that's going to survive this, right?
Well, this is something that's, I mean, there have been mass extinctions throughout Earth's history, and at no point has all life been completely eradicated. There are always going to be some extremophiles out there that are capable of surviving and even thriving under extreme conditions that kill you know, that kill basically everything that was used to the status quo. So these extremophiles are organisms that already live in environments that would be considered toxic by most other organisms, either extremely acidic, such as Yellowstone's hot springs, or by deep sea vents. And so these animals,
they're protected from that devastation, or they sort of get to use their traits that they've been, you know, surviving with to actually survive what other animals are being killed by.
So either they live in parts of the planet where they would be shielded from the worst of the effects of the eruptions, or they are already somewhat adapted to living under conditions that are similar to the toxic conditions that are being created for on land and in the oceans that many or even most other animals wouldn't be able to survive.
So maybe that iron-shelled snail will survive.
Maybe this could be a great opportunity for them, right?
Take over.
Right. So after all the volcanoes on Earth erupt, then it becomes the planet of the heavy metal snails.
Thanks for joining us today for Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. All of today's volcanic mysteries: how do scientists know a volcano is about to erupt? What would happen if Yellowstone's supervolcano erupted? And what if every volcano on Earth erupted at once? Are available as Life's Little Mysteries articles on our website, livescience.com. You can also find out more about these mysteries in this podcast's notes.
Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter for even more Life's Little Mysteries and for the latest science news. You can also join the conversation in our Live Science forums, where you can pose Life's Little Mysteries questions of your own, or even suggest topics for upcoming podcast episodes. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss out on new episodes.
What will we talk about next? It's a mystery.
Literally, it'll be another Life's Little Mystery.
Life's Little Mysteries is produced in conjunction with Audio Boom as part of their Audio Boom Originals Network.